Hello, 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 and welcome to the third episode of Conversations coverage of the 77th edition of the Cannes Film Festival. I'm Eliana.
And I'm Patrick. Hi.
Hi. So it is Tuesday the 21st. We've been here for just over a week,
seven or eight days.
We've seen quite a few films. I was wondering if you wanted to start off with, how are you feeling? How is it going?
Yeah, I mean, at this point of the festival, it's actually, you know, a legitimate question to ask, because especially this year, it started out very rough, I think. The first few days, I wasn't sure why I came here in terms of films, you know, I didn't see a lot of good stuff. And the films that I found good were the ones I had seen before the festival, actually, through screeners. So there was sort of this mismatch of expectations and the films I got to see here so far. But since a day or two, it's, you know, since yesterday or the day before, it's becoming a real festival now. So yes. I'm happy about that. And also today was one of the first days, maybe the first day, that I got proper sleep, which means I feel relatively rested right now, which, you know, helps also with the movies and staying awake. I think this is something you've been struggling with a bit.
Yes. One of our friends said that when I don't sleep for at least 7 hours, I don't like films. And I think that this is a very concise way to just address the whole entire festival experience. And it's very accurate.
Yeah. And how have you felt about the festival so far?
I would say more of the same. I've been struggling with consciousness, but also enjoying the various experiences, because sometimes it almost feels perhaps like you're floating in another sense and creating scenarios or films while you're sitting in another film, which is not always the point. But today we're going to try to discuss a few of the films that we've seen, which will be Une langue universelle, or A Universal Language, by Matthew Rankin, which appeared in Quinzaine des Cinéastes. It was a film that both you and I liked in different ways. I got to see it in a Q&A at the Théâtre Croisette. And do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I can introduce it, even though, yeah, it's a bit tricky. The director, Rankin, he described it as a Venn diagram of Winnipeg, Montreal, and Tehran. So those are the three cities that are sort of mixed together in this narrative here. And I think it's a nice quote. I just want to quote him here. He also said, Iranian cinema emerges out of 1,000 years of poetry, while Canadian cinema emerges out of 40 years of discount furniture commercials. And I think this is the sort of self-deprecation that we see very often from Canadian filmmakers.
Yes.
We have also had that in the Guy Madden film. What was that? What's
My
the title
Winnipeg
again?
Or... No, Rumors. The, Rumors.
Yeah, Rumors. Yeah.
Yes.
There were also these Canadian jokes.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's a very interesting mishmash, I think he's finding here. It's a collaboration with his two friends. I don't know how to pronounce their names, but Piruz Nemati and Ila Firuzabadi. And they've been friends for some time, and they've been collaborators on this one here. So they are also actors and screenwriters and producers. And yeah, they wanted to sort of bring together the best of each worlds, I suppose. One can clearly see one can clearly see certain inspirations for that film. I was especially struck by, I was thinking of The White Balloon by Jaffa Panahi. because there's this one scene here that is a frozen banknote of the Iranian currency, and two girls, they are trying to get it out of the ice. They can just see through the transparent ice the banknote, but have no means of getting it out there. But yeah, this film is very episodic, I would say. Mm-hmm. We have different locations. It's a bit like, it's almost Wes Anderson-ish. Whereas for me, Wes Anderson in his most recent films lacked this sort of,
character building or other
character
stuff.
I don't think there's a lot of character building in this film. Mm-hmm. You know, it's rather this, maybe humanity, in a sense, you know, like they didn't feel like characters anymore in his most recent films. Whereas here, these characters are really heartfelt, I think. There are scenes that are very touching, especially toward the end, and there are threads that are introduced and then seized toward the end of the film. So even though it's a very fragmented nature of the narrative, it still comes together as a whole, I would say. And yeah, the film starts off in this at the school. At the school, we have the wide shot of the school building, and we can watch through the window where we see a school class and a teacher, and it's a French class. Mm-hmm. And it's very funny. I think it gives you a good idea of the humor of the film overall, the tonality, because the pupils, they are all over the place, you know, very wild, not behaving very well, and the teacher said, could you at least be so decent and misbehave in French?
Yes. And I think, yes.
Yeah, this gives you an idea about the tonality of the film.
Yes, because it's in a sense it's an international school, but also a French school. So it's a school in Winnipeg where most of the students come from a Persian background, and they speak Farsi. And yet the teacher appears there with his tough love, and he's trying to teach them perhaps, quote unquote, civilization or French, which is also done in a way that's, as one would imagine, a complicated relationship with the French language. And the fact that in some sense, Tehran and Canada or Quebec, but even though this place takes place also in Winnipeg, which is also the funny part, all share this complexity with the French land and sovereignty or post or colonial past.
Yeah, and all these strange aspects about Winnipeg, as you know, when has to think of Guy Madden there,
yes,
as well.
Yes.
And all these weird traditions they have. Those feature here as well in some way or the other. There are also great scenes, just great place, like inventive and great character constellations and localities. There's this Kleenex store, for instance, that also that only sells Kleenex.
A Kleenex dispensary or repository or something. What do they call it?
Yeah, and there's a bingo. There's a bingo game that the local community takes part in, mm-hmm. and the winner. What do they win? They win a year's supply of Kleenex.
Yes.
So there's this obsession.
It's completely absurd yet very warm. I mean, speaking of Guy Madden, he said Winnipeg is always winter, always sleeping. And the director, too, also said something that was very much in this vein that you talked about earlier, that in a very dry humor way, he said, oh, there are two types of films that come out of Winnipeg. One, he said, rune porn. And the second, Christmas movies. And what he wanted to do as well was to find something in the middle. So this is very much that film. I mean, it got a very warm reception throughout, which is something that sometimes you miss when you're screening it at home alone, even though I think you felt it.
Yeah. But I was also thinking, there's certain scenes, certain jokes, I think, that would have worked very well with an audience. So yeah, I'm a bit sad that I missed out on that. But I could still sort of you know, could project which scenes would be like of a crowd pleasing nature. And as I said, it's very fragmented. So to me, it's also like when I talk about it, it's also a bit fragmented, but there are just certain scenes, certain aspects that I found so fascinating. There is this, one of the subplots is that there is a tourist group led by a tour guide. And this tour guide is at first introduced to us as almost a villainous, like at least antagonistic figure. But in the end, he turns out to, you know, just one of the guys we root for toward the end. But it gives us the different perspectives, and we see all these sites of whatever city it is in this moment. You know, is it Winnipeg? Is it, so there is this, for instance, there's the shopping mall they go through, and they're not allowed to rest for more than like 30 seconds or so at one spot. And what I really liked, and what reminded me a lot of Radu Judas' last film, there is this like bifurcation of highway lanes, and in between there, this very tight angle, there's a monument. There is, and all people go there to this very narrow strip of green or something, and they but it's as if, you know, in the Radu we also had these we had this highway where a lot of people died because it's so dangerous being there around, and we have this essayistic approach of seeing just for a few minutes just all these tombstones and so on. And here it's almost like beauty is to be found, but at the places that really don't allow it to flourish, and you have to sort of you have to get there yourself, and it's not at all advertised for you.
There was a lot of attention that was paid to the composition in this film, which speaks very much to your point about it being somewhat like Wes Anderson, even though there were some angles of the brutalist buildings that were so oblique and that made you feel like you were in some form of a labyrinth or a maze. And there's this, there are different palettes. So there are the yellow buildings, the gray buildings, the beige buildings. I mean, when you see someone eating in the film, they're eating, I mean, how many different types of food that could be white or beige can they possibly be eating? And there's this very funny joke, but I don't know if I should ruin it, but just, oh, how do you feel about your experience? Was it positive or was it neutral? and just this finding something in the monotony or in the seemingly nothingness is something where there's this resilient lightness that comes through even in the bleakest palettes, the bleakest of cities, the bleakest of places. And this tour guide, in this sense, he brings them on a tour of like events or places that are seemingly just what is the point of the tour? And then people on the tour even seem to feel a little bit, why am I here? But they still go along and they don't leave. They continue.
In that vein, I have one of my favorite quotes of the film that is, they come to this beige building you already mentioned, and so he makes a bit of fuss about this building, and they're wondering, so have there been famous people living in it? And he says, no, but very kind people. And
yes.
I think this sort of encapsulates the, like, how endearing this film is, and how, like, it's very warm. It is funny, but never like in a mean-spirited way. It's not satirical. It's rather something that feels very sincere.
Yes. It reminds me, in the spirit of, I saw an art tune or a political cartoon type like The New Yorker recently, where you see some people going on a tour of an art gallery, and the little caption underneath is, and this gallery showcases the work of artists who became known for doing a lot of administrative work and wasting their time in writing grants, emails, and doing social media. The artist is Pablo Helguera. But this sort of a vein of comedy and humor and warmth.
Yeah, and I think I liked as well in this film, like formally it is interesting. It's not just about like these warm moments. I think it's also it keeps you busy when you just look at what the film is trying to do aesthetically. I like these sort of contrasts of foreground and background, like what happens in the foreground, what happens in the background, and sometimes they are sort of at a weird interplay with one another. I also like the narrative aspect of that, that often we also have voice offs and like this very archaic almost mode of dialogue, you know, when you see a car in the distance, mm-hmm. but you hear still the dialogues as if they are close by. It felt very antiquated, but in a like very charming way.
Yeah,
I think we also want to rush through some other films, so maybe we leave it at that.
Yes.
And so we agreed upon that this would be more or less our starting point, but from here it's very free-floating. So
it is free-floating.
Is there a film you want to transition to?
We have a few. Should we just name a few that we've seen and then we can maybe pick one?
Or just pick one as you like.
All right. Do you want to talk about Josh Mond? Mond or...
Yeah, Josh Mond, I think.
Josh Mond.
Yeah.
It Doesn't Matter.
Right.
So It Doesn't Matter featured in the parallel section of Acid, which is the independent cinema and its distribution section. And it is... They're usually 14... Well, they're 14 films this year. 9 features, 6... No, that's not 14, but... Okay, it doesn't matter. I'll cut. And you're a big sort of fan of Josh Mond's first feature, so you are quite looking forward to this second feature, because it's been a few years since he's made a film.
Right, and one doesn't really know what happened since. it's very strange. Josh Mond was really his first film. James White was hailed in 2015, I think, when it played, I think, at Sundance at the time, and it got a lot of awards, a lot of like a best debut of the year and so on. So there was a lot of prospect, I think, a lot of hope associated with his name. And it strikes you a bit of, you know, as an odd occurrence that nothing has followed since then. And now this film that seems, of all films, this is not what I would have expected, maybe what anyone would have expected from Josh Mond's vision. But here we are. We are in a very small side section of Cannes, and this film is very much a mixture of everything. it's in between. Like even formally, we have cinema cameras, really, but then we have parts that seem more like vlog-esque. We have in the center of the story, if you want, we have two friends. The one is a filmmaker and played by Christopher Abbott.
Mm-hmm.
And the protagonist is actually Alvaro. That's a debut performance, more or less, by Jay Will. So there was a discovery by the team behind. I think he just graduated from Juilliard or something. So he's very good. He has a very strong presence. And yeah, what's happening in this film is very... I mean, when we said that the first film was very fragmented, this is much more the case here.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, very... facetiously almost, Josh Mond was asked if in interviews what kind of genre that is, and and if it doesn't, if it matters at all. And of course his answer was, it doesn't matter. So very interesting. To me, it's even a coming of age story. I don't know how you felt about that, but to me this was sort of a through line throughout, and it not only spans around a decade or so, it also leads us through several states of the United States. We are in Oregon, we are in New York, we are in Colorado, we are in Hawaii, and at the end we even end up in Paris, so it even goes across the Atlantic. And yeah, what happens, it's difficult to tell, but the protagonist, Alvaro, he's this person who's always on the fence of homelessness.
Yes.
And we have this ongoing conversation,
yeah,
especially to his, it seems, best friend, the Christopher Abbott character. But yeah, what was your impression?
Like all nice films that have dialogue or conversation, this is definitely one of them. It's interesting to hear that you find it as kind of a coming of age story, because I think there is definitely that element in it. Yet the age of the protagonist that seems to be wandering and always on the verge of homelessness is somewhat unknown, but there's something also relatable in the way that he perambulates, but everything is a story. It's a story that leads to another story that leads to another story. And most of the conversations and the exchanges that happen take place from iPhone footage of even just like, I don't know, FaceTime or video chat calling. And it was ultimately a story that reminded me a bit of, it was not as poetic or interrupted, but of what we saw in the Berlinale, Was hast du gestern geträumt, Parajanov?
I have.
By Faraz Fersharaki.
Yeah, it's a difficult name for
And
me.
In that, things begin with a call. Things begin with this initial instinct to want to communicate and connect, and from there that instinct in its of itself, some form of creation, and it leads to a journey and just the telling of stories. So first we see the protagonists and they're separate in separate spaces, and at some point they also unite and there's some tension. There was really everything in this film, and such a very, I didn't know, it was a very empowering way that these things came together ultimately. I was also there because I think I really like these Q&As, and I was there for the Q&A in the Arcade, which is a smaller, more intimate cinema. And the director also has quite a sense of humor. He has a very like New York type of sense of humor. I'm not entirely sure if he's from New York, but he said that it also started by chatting with his co-writer, and then from there he made a visual script with Alice DeMata, and from there he was very just open about it. He just said, I didn't even know what I wanted to make, but it was through doing this and through the belief and trust of others that we were all able to find out what it was that we wanted to make. And I think that very much carries it. He also said some things like, COVID happened, you find out who your real friends are. It's kind of sad, but also not, because then you just know. And so he's embracing the part of knowing that. And I think this film ultimately can be quite confusing depending on what type of an audience or what sort of thing you're looking for to see, because it occurred to me that I might have actually seen James White while I was doing a little bit of research. And this was also a very different type of story, but about a son who's trying to figure out his own path in some sense, giving the restraints of his mother.
You could even argue that was a story, and this here is, some people wouldn't even categorize it as a story in itself, but rather different vignettes that come together.
And
the filmmaker also said that it was primarily his friend who tells all these stories that he found himself so enchanted by. And what I still wanted to say, this coming of age aspect that I mentioned earlier and that you were somewhat skeptical of, maybe I think I just liked how it comes together in the end, that I don't want to give that away, but there is this idea that Alvaro, the protagonist, finds something in his past that sort of guides him toward what his future might be looking like, which is very much, you know, embedded with cinema itself. And also, there is this aspect toward the end, maybe it starts really in the last third of the movie, that he becomes more and more conscious of what he wants in life, and he takes on certain directives for how to lead his life. I really love this motif in this film that fall forward. You know, there is this phrase fall forward, and this is such a great encapsulation of whatever happens to you, try to remain in control of things. And there was this other, I think there was another quote, you know, it almost sounds a bit like he found like coach on YouTube or something then he now tries to emulate. But there's this quote also where he says, don't aspire to make a living, aspire to make a difference. And of course, those things can sound very cheesy easily, but in the film sort of transports a sense of growth, I think, toward the end, without it ever feeling forced in any way, because this narrative is so disparate and is so vignette-like that you don't get the sense that there is like something that is enforced upon you. And one of the elements we haven't mentioned yet is, of course, the animation. And primarily, Anthony F. Shepard was the force behind the driving force. And it's really, I think, quite inventive and quite original, the way not only how the animation is embedded here or sort of, taking on its own life within the story, but also the graphics itself.
Yeah. And he's recounting a story and the graphics become a way, like a visual aid to guide us through this. And I think animation is such a loose medium, whereas you have to calculate every single thing. At the same time, it allows for such a freedom and liberty of that there's basically limitless. And in this sense, the story becomes more than just something that might have happened in reality. It becomes more than that.
Yeah, and perhaps much more anarchical as well, which is something the film goes for.
I really liked its intensity and the quirkiness of it. Like when you see he's talking about a lady that pulls up on the car, and then we are introduced to the lady first, chest forward, and then he's asked to come into the car, and he tries to go into the car with her, and then slams the car door on his foot. And it's just really, it's really fantastic.
And I saw that film with a friend of mine, and when that happened and his phone breaks, or the screen at least, she was like, oh no. And it's so strange because it doesn't seem like a lot, but actually in that scene he doesn't have anything, so having his phone broken like this is
it sets him back. He has to go to work to try to fix it, get the money to fix it too.
But yeah, I think we should go on here. But I think we would recommend that film as well, right?
To a very specific
set. Yeah, but I think it's also a film that just stands out here, right?
And it is a film that's very positive, that ultimately says, like, go out and make films. Go out and find your friends and make films.
Yeah.
I would say.
I mean, I don't need like something affirmative like that in films, but I guess it can uplift your mood as well.
Yeah.
And perhaps, I don't know, like, would you feel ready to talk about Jonas Trüber's The Other Way Around?
We can.
There was, until I saw Enora earlier today, new Sean Baker film, that was my number one so far.
I thought your number one was Blue Sun Palace.
Oh, those things change, but Jonas Trüber, The Other Way Around, I cannot and won't try to use the original title in Spanish here. But
Volveré, yes.
Yeah, he's a filmmaker from Madrid. who's already made like 7 or 8 films or so. And this is one I, you know, often when you go to these festivals, there's so many films in the selection that you don't even notice that you have already seen films by certain filmmakers. And this was one of those instances where I didn't realize that I had seen a film by Trüba from 2021. It's called Who's Stopping Us? It's the sort of docu-fiction. It's in between. It follows this group of adolescents and just tries to capture this moment that seems for a lot of youngsters so difficult to come up with a positive notion and vision of the future. And this film sort of, tries to frame that in 3.5 hours, quite a long film. But that was my only film I've seen by him. And this new one now, The Other Way Around, it's that won me over from the first scene, I think. In the first scene, I think it's good to mention that because it gives us an idea what the film is about. It basically lays out its present.
Pretext? Oh, no.
It's premise.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and we see a couple, a married couple in their bed together at night, and they discuss divorce. And the female character, her father, always had this idea that he was low-key proud of, apparently, that not only should we all celebrate weddings, we should also have something like akin to that, but for the opposite, that would be
for
a
separations.
Divorce. Yeah, separations, divorce. One should have a party for that as well. One should invite people and sort of celebrate the freedom that comes along with that as well.
Yes.
And there's from the very beginning, there is this unrecognized or unadmitted power disbalance between the two, in the sense that you're not quite sure who is perhaps pressuring whom into this idea. But from then on, they acknowledge to each other that, oh, I'm fine with that, but now they have to go along with it.
Yes, and there's a playfulness. Oh, sorry.
No.
And there's a playfulness as well, which also is a heavy recurring theme, where they notice, that would make a good film.
Right. Yeah, I think that's from the beginning. And
yes.
At first you think, oh, isn't that a bit forced? But it turns out they are both in the film industry. He is an actor.
Yes.
She is a director, among other things. She's also an editor as well. And yeah, so it makes sort of sense. And yeah, this film has these meta elements as well that we can get into in a bit. I think what is central here is now that they have this idea, and now they talk to family and friends.
Yes.
And they tell the same story again and again. And I feel like what in, let's say, comedies, or like, you can say this is a comedy, but it's not like a ha-ha comedy. It's rather something that feels true to life as well. And here there is this element of, you know, it starts from this very first, like the spark of the idea to then becoming more and more performative, because the more often they say it, the more and more they have sort of practiced the lines, so to speak.
Yeah.
And it becomes sort of solid. They repeat the same things again and again. And this later takes on, one of the leitmotifs of this film.
I would say that for me, watching the first half is kind of like a Seinfeld episode. I mean, I don't mean it in any way, but where you have a concept and then it's being harped on and you're going around and you're explaining it to all your friends. But then the second half does play with that in a very smart way that adds a level of profundity.
But I think in a Seinfeld episode, I would think you often perhaps would have this one idea notion and just through...
But you haven't watched Seinfeld.
I'm just thinking of, you know, like these old comedies.
Yeah.
Like, and I know it was considered to be one of the more formative ones for many people and more daring ones. But if I think of sitcoms and so on, they often have this one idea that they lay out the premise and then they yeah. go through that for like 20 minutes or so.
Yes. Whereas, and then the episode is over.
Whereas but, here, yeah. it seems more like a starting point for this. And there is this change in dynamic.
Yes. And I think that is what ultimately makes it a fuller picture.
Yeah, because there is, as I said, it becomes performative, but then they become conscious of the performance aspect as well.
Yes.
And they get annoyed with the performance aspect as yes. well.
The performance aspect takes on so many different aspects that they're even jokingly at some point. I don't know if we should really talk more about it or if we
yeah,
should.
Sure.
But that they even jokingly edit. We're shown sequences and it somewhat becomes unclear whether they are actually going through with the initial idea, oh, this is a good idea, we should make it into a film, and they are making it into a film as we're seeing both the film as presented and the film as being edited and the film as in progress, and it's not certain at all, even though one can also say, okay, you know, just step back from these multiple layers of meta and just say, okay, what we are seeing is also in a sense the finished film too, depending on how you look at it. I don't know if that's how you saw it. And I did appreciate how smart it was without being overtly as if to really delineate between these different worlds, but to have them collide and have them collide in a sense where we can feel that the characters are also developing, like you say, their idea of whether the separation is something that they will go through with, the separation, the celebration and the separation.
Yeah, and I think this meta aspect is, it's, I think a lot of people get easily annoyed by these meta aspects. But I think the way the movie incorporates this is very smart. I think there's this scene, for instance, when the husband walks along a bridge.
Yes.
And it takes some time for him to do that. And then we see this film in the editing room,
yes.
as well, where they note that, oh no, that's too long. We have
yeah.
to cut it a bit. And I don't know how you felt about it, that, but I found it somewhat refreshing, the milieu, because, I mean, it's the oldest thing in the world that a film is about filmmaking, right?
Yeah.
But here, I haven't seen that often, that we are so close into the milieu of filmmaking, because we have like test screenings and we have all these people they talk to, and I don't feel like I've seen that so often in films, that we see test screenings and stuff.
Yeah. This is a bit different, but I'm thinking about the Kloppenstein that we saw recently. This
oh,
is
yeah,
quite
very mainstream film, of course.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm sure
the most
all
mainstream.
Of our listeners have heard of Kloppenstein.
I was thinking about that. It's a bit different, though, because, but there is something to it that feels inherently similar, even though it's very, very different. Very, very different. But it became unclear how much film footage we see, and we also see in this film, I can't remember the name of it right now.
Yeah, me neither.
Him editing, and the edits becoming also part of the film, but it's done in a different, in a slightly different way.
Yeah,
but
I think so too. And we have the, I think we can give that away, this repetition element that we've addressed here a lot. It's also founded in the theory of Kierkegaard, who has written this book, Repetition. And this book is actually given to the female lead,
yes.
By her father. And I really like this line. I don't know if you recall when she addresses this idea that they want to go with his idea,
yeah.
of doing this divorce celebration. And he gives her a lot of theory.
Yes.
He gives her a lot of books about
yes.
cinema.
A
and
reading list.
What have you. Yeah, exactly. And then she says, oh, yeah, you're giving me an entire bibliography here. And he says, well, as a father, isn't that what I'm supposed to do? Very fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is this idea, then it's almost like a thesis statement of the film, that the happy love comes through repetition, mm-hmm. that the ongoing repetitions is what gives mm-hmm. you some sort of satisfaction, mm-hmm. and that these more like unique encounters are bound to make you depressed because you think, oh, I want to experience that again. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you can find pleasure in repeating the same things again and again, mm-hmm. You might be closer to happiness. I found that compelling in any case.
There are a million ways, I think, to talk about that. I personally don't feel that the film really went to the depths of exploring that, and it stayed more on the surface level of being very warm and comical. But I do very much like that ultimate theory, or considering that theory of repetition as a means of finding a ritual of pleasure or ritual of routine that gives you some form of grounding, just being grounded.
Yeah, and in that respect, they also refer to Liv Ullmann and Ingmar Bergman and this mm-hmm. game they had that they would sort of rate every day, and they would either cross the day out or they would give it a heart or something, like they had this system. And yeah, so you could see that the film also has a lot of knowledge mm-hmm. to share about cinema. And that's really one of my favorites of the festival. And good to see that the Kansan, continues to be one of the more interesting sections here at the festival. Yes. Yeah, I think we have time for perhaps one more film. So I leave that to you, what you would like to.
So we haven't really talked much about in competition films.
Right.
And I was wondering if you had any hot takes, any quick takes, any reactions or any instinctive feelings about some of the ones that you've seen thus far.
I think so far for me, it has rather been a disappointing, year with regards to competition. But today I did see the Sean Baker, and that was clearly the standout so far, as I had hoped it to be. Yeah, a lot of rather, films that were either without ambition, I felt. Like there was this film from Romania. I even forgot the title.
3 kilometers.
Yeah, exactly. That felt, it was about, it had an interesting idea, but it was so transparent that I don't think that it challenged, our outlook on homophobia in these like rural states, regions of the country, especially. It had this sort of premise that the victim becomes or is seen as the perpetrator. And I think I won't go into that, but maybe I can. It's just this idea that there is this adolescent boy who apparently has some homosexual relations, and but he is also beaten down very harshly by some rowdies there who just because he kisses another boy. And then he is clearly the victim here, but once the parents who are, who file a complaint, is that what you say? No, not a complaint, right? Who file?
Yeah.
Who file charges?
Okay.
And
press charges,
Who press charges once they find out what their son did, that he kissed another boy, then they try to cover this all up, and try to stay away from these charges, because once they are brought to the public, his homosexuality will also become public. It's like conceptually interesting, but it's so transparent that it doesn't, it didn't leave a mark on me.
Speaking of conceptually interesting and not necessarily leaving a mark, a Unfortunately, I would have to say that about Armand as well. But I think it will leave a little bit of a mark. There have been a lot of films. Sorry to just pivot. But there have been a lot of films this year in at Cannes that seem to be discussing education in some sense. I mean, I think that is also the usual. But Armand particularly was a Norwegian film that was by, I believe, a debut feature from Halfdan Ullmann Tundel. I'm not really sure how to pronounce that O.
Mm-hmm.
And it appeared in Un Certain Regard. And it was the story...
Renate Reinswer as the lead actor.
Yes, Renate Reinswer as lead actor, who we've seen most recently in Worst Person in the World, as well as Bernale film.
Yeah, and one can tell how he got her as the lead actor, because apparently he also was assistant director for Joachim Trier for Thelma. I think it starts promising, no?
It starts quite promising. It's a story about parents who are brought to talk into, like, as an unofficial parent-teacher conference, but meeting rather, to discuss their children's behavior. And Renata's character is a mother of the boy who is allegedly sexually assaulted another boy of 6 years old in the classroom. We never hear from the two boys directly, but we instead hear from the mediation process that occurs, which first starts from the new incoming sort of homeroom teacher, and then the other teachers get involved, and we slowly see how everyone, we understand their relation to one another, and the idea of Renata Renzi's character as a single mother in some sense is put on trial. And there are also other aspects that are questioning, how are we supposed to really approach this sort of an incident? How do we even prove it? Number one, is it just an allegation? The boy who has been potentially attacked comes home to his parents one day, and the parents then relay and complain to the teachers what they understand to have happened to the boy. And different parts come out here and there in terms of trying to fill out the story, and there's different weight that's given to all the characters to give them some form of depth. And ultimately, it became a bit, for me, like a Scandinavian drama. I think that they often are very good, like a TV drama that you might see on Thursday night on Arte. But it did also remind me of another TV drama I'd seen that's called, I think, Die Twelve, which is about a mother, but maybe it's Danish, but which is about a mother who is accused of having murdered her daughter. And so they have the first part has very interesting tension, very interesting issues are raised. And I was, you know, how did you find it?
Yeah, I think this first part is really great. I thought we're in for a great film, actually. But I find it almost insane how it develops. You know, it sort of starts like an Ibsen, you know, an Ibsen play, and it becomes more and more a soap opera.
Yeah.
And the length in which it does that, I find it hard to believe what the film does toward the end, where, you know, you all know these scenes where characters are in the pouring rain staring at each other.
This was my interpretation of a Harry Potter scene that we've seen in some film. That's all I'll say.
Yeah. And there's this scene I think I'll never forget with Renate Reinswer. She has the scene which is sort of the centerpiece of the film, and I think when you see this film you will never forget that one scene, because I can imagine that films have done something like that in the past, but I think I'm almost sure no film has ever done it to quite the extent that this film is doing that.
This scene is really incredible. I shouldn't say anything more about it too, because I think it's just something to be seen and not really to be discussed.
Yeah, but
there are many like idioms that might refer to it, and it calls into the idea of, are emotions intentional? to some degree.
But I think the film is very almost cowardly, you know, sort of rejecting its initial premise and rather moving on to much more easily solved, conflicts.
Lower hanging fruit of vendettas and...
Among the
complex
parents and
yes.
Among the grown-ups. Because how do you actually react to something like that if that were really to happen?
Yes.
How do you react to a boy of 6 years trying to penetrate another boy, you know? Like,
yes, which is the alleged incident.
Exactly. This is, I mean... And, you know, at the beginning, I think the Renate Reinswe character, before there is something that seems like mental illness that is, you know, forced upon her character.
Yeah.
Before we go into that and kind of psychologize her character, it's actually quite fascinating. How do you, because she is also informed only in the presence of, you know,
yeah,
the teacher.
Of the teacher and the other parents.
Exactly.
Which is such a, I mean, even the teachers before, in the scene before we even meet Renate Reinswe's character, we hear the teachers discussing what is the procedure for this. They don't even know what to do. They're
exactly,
like, oh, I guess we'll make it up as we go in the very serious
there's
Scandi
no
form- drama way.
There's no protocol. There's no formula for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, not a film that I would recommend, like as a like as an accomplished film. But I feel like if the film had been more daring, if this film had been more courageous, this could have been one of the stunners of the festival. Yeah.
And
maybe we have a bit of time for a last film, and I'll leave that to you. What kind of film would you like to?
I mean, I think it sort of lends itself to talking to Apprendre, which is the new documentary by Claire Simon, which takes place in Ivry-sur-Seine. So
that's close to Paris.
Yes, it's really just one stop right outside of Paris to the southeast. And we follow in just children in an elementary school, and we see how they are received by the teachers there. We see what their ongoing daily routines are like. And I think Claire Simon is very good at just placing the camera somewhere and letting things happen. I mean, I do think there is a bit of a process there in terms of talking with the people that she works with, but there's a great sense of safety. And this is also following her most recent documentary, Notre Corps, which was about 3 hours long and was in the Berlinale of last year.
Right.
And
in our top tens, I think.
Yes, and in our top tens. And this film returns in some sense to childhood. For me, watching it was warm. And the film is called Apprendre. The English title is Elementary, which I think is a bit limited in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a verb to an adjective.
yes. And there's so many different questions that you can see emerging. You see first the students. I mean, Ivry-sur-Seine, you have a mixed body of, I mean, just being right outside of Paris, there's a socioeconomic aspect to the type of school that we're entering. I mean, when I was watching it, I was wondering, is this the so-called average school in France that we are approaching right before they go to middle school? The children all come from different backgrounds. They all play with each other. They're all very lovely. They touch each other, but they also bully each other, and they also interact and they talk about things like religion. And we see how the students and the teachers engage with them.
Okay, and in that respect, I would be curious how Claire Simon herself interacts here and interferes.
I believe she did the camera work.
But is she herself addressed in the film?
No,
at all?
She isn't. She isn't.
I think that's a flaw. I think that's, you know, it felt the same to me with Ruth Beckermann, She had her film in this year's Berlinale. Favoriten. It's called Favoriten. Yeah. And the way that her presence is hardly acknowledged in the film, in some scenes it is. But I think it's strange that you have, you know, shot, reverse shot, but then the camera that we just, you know, from whose perspective we just saw the scene is now not there anymore. But, you know, it's the same scene. We are still like in the next second or so. And I find it so strange that you have, you know, a documentary which then shies away from, you know, confronting us with the documentary aspect of it, of the filmmaking aspect of it.
You mean just in being more transparent
about it? Yeah.
Yeah. I think it is sort of hard. When I spoke to someone, they said that they were a little bit disappointed with this Claire Simon as well. I wouldn't say that it was perhaps the strongest of films.
But you know what I mean is
in terms of the transparent...
That pupils, you know, they act differently in front of a camera.
Yes. And yes, and we can see that they make eye contact with the camera from time to time. And I think the thing that she also, this person who was disappointed with, she felt, which I can also understand, because there's a very tedious line between just like how much is what we are seeing in front of us being performed or provoked, or how much is someone like leading these children, especially since they're children, into a conversation.
And you know,
as such,
like, you know, I don't want to talk about too much about Favoriten here, but with Ruth Beckermann, it was almost ridiculous because the way she said it, it was like, oh yeah, the children were very natural in front of the camera. Yeah. And I think, how are you to say how natural or unnatural they are? You know, that's not on you to say. Mm-hmm. And I just feel it would make for a more believable
I think I'm sort
experience.
Of slowly getting there. What I did find that was curious about this film was that it unveiled some of the tensions. So we saw that there were some students who were bullying other students. We saw that there was a clear bias on the part of some students to prefer each other or not to prefer, to even exclude others. And we saw that some students also came in. And there was, for me, I did believe that the students that did express their views, whether they be parroting that of what they hear at home, there were some students who were Muslim. There was one student that was very almost funny, but he sounded also as if he were, he said that he doesn't always have time during the day to pray, but as he's Muslim, he'll wait and then he'll go home at night and he'll pray 14 times in a row. And then another student says, what? That's what you call practicing your religion? So there's something with it that's also playing with just the conceptions that children have at that age. And I think that that was well delivered, regardless of whether how transparent perhaps the filmmaking was. But I do agree with you in general. Curious to see how you'll find it, of course, because we can also, there are some students who clearly need more help than other students. I mean, there's something a bit performative too about the fact that when we are introduced to a classroom, the teacher, which I find actually quite endearing, because I can't help but draw a parallel or comparison with the way that I was educated in America. And often, you know, when they do roll call, you're just, the teacher looks up, sees if you're there, maybe calls your name, and then you're just a little check, a check. But in this instance, the teacher would name everyone and then just sort of ask, check in with them, how are you? Mm. Not with every single student, but with some of them, have a little chat, say, take off your jacket. But then there's also an aspect with the person I talked to, they said, oh, but one student, I wonder too, if he didn't take off his jacket because perhaps he only had that jacket. He didn't have a shirt underneath the jacket. And
oh, that's good.
There's something about the way that the teachers are there too, and the fragility perhaps of who they might be. Like, who are these people who are to teach the next generation?
Right.
And what background should they come from? What sort of teaching methods do they use? One boy asks, when they're in geography class and they're learning about different continents, is it true that there are ghosts in Asia and Africa? And the teacher responds, I can't really say. It depends upon what you believe. And there's something that was a very nice way of addressing it, but also I hope that it goes further. They're given these books of I think they're given a dictionary or some form of like an encyclopedia as well that they all read. And I'd found it to be insightful in the strangest of ways, in the ways that I didn't expect it to be, both on maybe an internal contemplative way, but also in seeing, this is one mode in which education occurs, and made me question, because it's not really enforcing and saying that this is the type of way that we should be taught. There is one student, so following off of Armand, there is one student that's a bit disruptive. And so he's invited to go talk with someone, and they say, you know, you can't do that. You're a smart guy. So smart people, we use words. We don't use our fists. And this is different, obviously, from the theme in Armand that happens, because it's not as extreme. But still is a greater question of how do you address such conflicts?
Well, you know, that's a scene I recognize without having seen it from the Ruud Beckerman film as well. I think this is a scene that is inevitable when you talk, you know, when you make a film on children in schools. Because the aspect of violence will always be.
There's one last thing that I did want to mention that I thought was quite curious, but it was that the person who I was talking to also mentioned, which was something that kind of went over my head, that the female teacher was sort of wearing clothes that seemed a bit revealing for her taste. And I also observed that the male teacher, the main male teacher, because there were more female teachers, there was also a musical class section as well. The male teacher would like rub the students' shoulders. And I feel like in America, at least, there's this sense that you shouldn't be like this. And there were also moments where the teachers were holding hands with the children. And it's just like right at that border where you're so impressionable, but where touch is still permissed.
And that is the about dry grasses discourse as well.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. But I think we have to wrap it up here because our next screening is in 7 minutes.
Yes.
We can already announce that our next episode is going to be themed. We want to take a look.
We're going to go to the East.
Yeah, which is to say, especially Asian-focused cinema. We'll take a look, for instance, at the new Jia Zhangke, which was one of the better reviewed films here at the festival, certainly in the competition. And yeah, we'll have time to talk about a few other films like the debut Blue Sun Palace that I was really impressed by. And just stay tuned. I think there will be one or two other titles. And we will probably have a guest, but we won't announce that now because then we jinx it. And
yes.
We'll see. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ciao.